trying to balance her packages while keeping track of two young children. Joy to the world and all that. Chapter 2. Miri. Sunday was frigid, gray, and windy. At Newark Airport, a new low of 6 degrees was recorded at 7 a.m. But Miri, asleep in her bed under a puffy quilt, didn't give two figs about the weather. She was dreaming of the mystery boy she'd danced with last night. She was good at that, at deciding what she'd dream about, then doing it. When her alarm went off at 8 a.m., she reached out and turned it off. She threw on her robe and hustled to the kitchen, where she prepared two eggs boiled exactly 3 minutes, dark rye toast slathered with butter, fresh-squeezed orange juice, and coffee with real cream and two sugars. She decorated the tray with a paper doily and a flower plucked from the arrangement on the hall table, a gift from Rusty's boss and his wife. Her mother's real name was Naomi, but because of her auburn hair, which was long and thick, everyone called her Rusty. People turned to stare when she walked by, as if maybe she was a movie star. Too bad Miri didn't get her mother's hair or her green eyes. Nobody stared when she walked by. When she presented the breakfast tray, Rusty acted all surprised, like she'd forgotten it was her birthday. Miri thought about the bed jackets displayed at Nia's. If she had had the money, she'd have bought one, so Rusty could have breakfast in bed in style on her birthday. "That was delicious," Rusty said when she'd finished her breakfast. Miri held out the gift from Nia's lingerie. "Breakfast in bed and a present?" Rusty said. "Should I open it?" Miri nodded. "What else would you do with a present?" Rusty untied the ribbon and rolled it up, then carefully removed the wrapping paper so it could be reused. Finally, she opened the box and pulled out the half slip. "This is exactly what I wanted!" She sounded as if she meant it. Miri was pleased. "And in navy," Rusty said. "It's perfect." "It's nylon tricot," Miri told her, "and if it's the wrong size, you can exchange it." "Thank you, sweetie," Rusty said, reaching for Miri. She hugged her and gave her a forehead kiss. "You're welcome, Mom." After Miri cleaned up the kitchen, she decided she'd finish her homework so she wouldn't have to do it later. But she couldn't keep her eyes open, so she climbed back into bed and snuggled under the covers. Ruby sat on the stool at the counter at Hanson's drugstore on 51st Street and 7th Avenue in New York City, savoring a scrumptious strawberry ice cream soda topped with whipped cream, chopped nuts, and a maraschino cherry. She saved the cherry for last. When she bit into it, Jimmy, the soda jerk, said, "You're not supposed to eat those things." "Why not?" "They're for decoration. Too many of them will kill you." "But just one will make you happy, right?"
"If you say so."
Hanson's was a celebrity hangout where Ruby was sometimes recognized, not that she minded, and where she often chatted with other entertainers, many of them famous, way more famous than her. But on this Sunday morning, it was quiet, probably because of the miserable weather. She'd been a morning guest on WJZ, broadcast from Howie's Restaurant on 6th Avenue between 52nd and 53rd, and from there, she'd walked over to Hanson's. So what if she ordered an ice cream soda before lunch? Who was going to tell her she couldn't have exactly what she wanted? Being the only customer gave her the chance to flirt with Jimmy, a Broadway gypsy who worked behind the soda fountain between shows. Geez, he was so cute. Once upon a time, Ruby and Jimmy had shared a backstage kiss, but it never went any further. Ruby knew better than to fall for a dancer. Besides, she'd heard he liked boys as much as girls. Anyway, She was romantically involved with Danny Thomas's brother Paul now. She didn't know yet if it was going to turn into something more serious or not. Her mother was always nagging, "Get married while you still have your looks, Ruby, and for God's sake, marry up. Having money beats the dickens out of being poor." As if Ruby didn't know. Sorry, Mom, but she was nowhere near ready for marriage. She had a career to think about, and she expected to have her looks for a long time. Her agent was trying to get her on Ed Sullivan. He thought she had a good shot. A movie musical wouldn't hurt either. Maybe Danny Thomas would put her in his next picture. Nothing wrong with pulling a few strings while she was dating his brother. "What time's your plane, babe?" Jimmy asked. "Last time I checked, it was 2 hours late." She looked down at the watch Paul had given her for her birthday, a pink gold Bulova. The tiny hands told her it was almost 10:30. "Oops, I'm supposed to be at the airport before noon," she said, collecting her things and paying for the ice cream soda. Jimmy leaned in to give her a goodbye kiss on her cheek. At the last second, she turned her face, so his kiss landed on her lips, surprising him. "Mmm, strawberry," Jimmy said, licking his lips, making Ruby laugh. "Have a good trip, babe, and come back soon."
"You know I will."
Ruby blew him a flirty kiss. Ruby loved to travel. Give her an airline ticket and she'd be on the next plane. She liked staying at hotels where someone made the bed for her every day and brought her clean towels. Even when the hotels were less than classy, even when they were on the sleazy side, which was often, she still liked being on the road. Miri. Just before noon, Rusty found Miri still asleep in her bed. She shook her gently. "Come on, honey, get up. Let's go to an early show at the Elmora." Miri rolled over, but didn't open her eyes. "Hurry, or we're going to miss it." Being the only child meant Miri was often her mother's companion, and if Rusty wanted to go to the movies today, she'd go with her. After all, it was her birthday. Miri threw on dungarees, a turtleneck, a heavy sweater over that, and thick white socks. She tied her saddle shoes, ran the toothbrush over her teeth, not bothering to brush up and down the way Dr. Osner had taught her, pulled her hair back sloppily, and got into her winter jacket, mittens, red and black striped Rutgers scarf, and fuzzy earmuffs. Miri and Rusty walked the mile up to the Elmora Theater. No bright winter sun today, just gray sky and freezing cold. Until this year, Miri could still get into the movies for a quarter, but not anymore. This was both good and bad. Good because she looked older, bad because she had to pay full price for a ticket. She'd be the first of her friends to turn 15, the age at which she was sure life would fall into place and at least some of her dreams would come true, starting with the strange, enchanted boy from last night's party. At the concession stand, Rusty bought a Milky Way for Miri, not bothering to ask if Miri had had a proper breakfast, which she hadn't, and a box of goobers for herself. "What the heck?" Rusty said to little Mary, who worked behind the counter. "It's my birthday."
"Happy birthday, hon," little Mary said. "I'd give you a soda on the house, but then I'd be fired."
The 12:30 show was a double feature. First, You Never Can Tell, with Dick Powell and Peggy Dow. A dog dies and is reincarnated into a private eye. Rusty loved screwball comedies. Miri preferred her movies torrid and dark. The feature attraction was Across the Wide Missouri with Clark Gable. Halfway through, Rusty leaned over and said, "Time to go. We have to change for dinner." Now Miri would never find out what happened to Clark Gable or his Indian wife. Ruby. At Newark Airport, the Miami Airlines plane was delayed again with no explanation.
No wonder Dana had tried to dissuade her from taking the non-scheduled flight to Tampa, then Miami. "Non-skeds are unreliable," Dana said. Ruby argued how much cheaper this flight was than the others. Really, what was the difference? An airplane is an airplane. It gets you where you want to go. So non-skeds don't have a regular schedule like a train or a bus. Who cares? Besides, she was impatient. The sooner she got to Florida, the better. She'd been dreaming of balmy beaches and soft moonlit nights. She couldn't wait to get away from this awful weather. So what if she had to wait another hour or two? She took a seat in the departure lounge, adjusted her skirt, and pulled the book she was reading from her oversized purse, glad she had a gripping mystery to distract her. She was aware of the glances coming her way, at the sight of a pretty girl reading I, the Jury by Mickey Spillane, known for his racy language. But Ruby didn't give a hoot. Let them look. Let them stare. It was nothing to her. Across from her, an older couple were talking in voices loud enough for her to hear. The wife said, "You have a long drive. You should get going. And don't forget to pick up my voluptes from Irene Ammerman. You remember where she lives?" He said, "I'm not leaving until I see you on the plane." "That's sweet, Ben, but it doesn't make sense."
"It makes sense to me."
She laughed. "You're such a romantic."
"Me? You're calling me a romantic?"
"Maybe not every day, but when it counts." He laughed and kissed her. She said, "Ben, people can see."
"So, I'm not allowed to kiss my wife in public after 35 years?
Ruby smiled to herself. She couldn't remember a time when her parents kidded around that way.
"Excuse me," a young man said, "but is anyone sitting here?"
Ruby sighed and moved her bag, meant to discourage other passengers from sitting next to her. He sat down, hoping to start up a conversation, she could tell.
"My mother thinks I'm driving to Florida," he said. "Either that or taking the train. I have 6 brothers. Every one of us served overseas. I'm the youngest."
"I thought there was a rule about not allowing all the sons in a family to serve."
"Well, they took us. We wanted to serve. And we all came back."
He smiled at her.
"What about you?"
She didn't feel like telling him she was a dancer. So she said, "My fiancé is in Miami. He was in the war, too. I'm going down for the holidays to stay with him and his family." The look on his face said it all, surprise and disappointment. After all, she wasn't wearing a ring. She felt bad. He seemed like a nice boy, but there was no point. "I'll bet you'll have a great time in Miami," she said.
"Do you have any single friends there?"
he asked.
"Maybe your fiancé has a sister?"
"No, sorry. But I'm sure you won't have any trouble meeting girls. You're a very nice-looking young man."
"Not so young. I'll be 25 on my next birthday."
"I never would have guessed."
"How about you?"
22.
"Could have fooled me."
"Younger or older?"
"Younger, of course."
She laughed. "Of course.
I'm Paul Stefanelli, by the way,"
he said, holding out his hand. "Ruby Granick," she told him, letting him shake hers.
"How's the book, Ruby?"
He nodded at the book on her lap. "Can't put it down," she said. "So, if you'll excuse me..."
"Sure, I get it."
He got up and wandered away. Leah. Leah Cohen was hoping Henry Ammerman would pop the question soon, maybe over the holidays. She was going to his house later today to celebrate his sister Rusty's birthday. Henry's mother sold volupte compacts wholesale. A girl could never have too many voluptes. She'd probably get a few from the mothers of the children in her second-grade class. Last year she did. They sure beat fruitcakes, which she gave away, or bad perfume, which she poured down the toilet.
She knew in order to win Henry, she'd have to win the rest of his family, and she felt she was doing a pretty good job of it, mainly by keeping her mouth shut. They thought she was shy, quiet, a nice girl from a nice Cleveland family, a teacher. And she was all that, wasn't she? She'd been seeing Henry for almost 18 months. She'd met him at a party given by one of the other teachers at her school after she'd moved to New Jersey to live with her Aunt Alma. Her mother swore the only way she'd let Leah leave Cleveland was if she lived with family. Alma, her mother's sister, liked the idea of Leah sharing her house and helping with the expenses. As far as Leah was concerned, anything was better than staying in Cleveland and living with her parents. Aunt Alma was a retired school secretary who'd never married. A maiden aunt, Leah's mother called her, but one who played canasta with her friends 3 afternoons a week and volunteered at the hospital every Friday morning. Alma approved of Henry and had told Leah's mother so. Well, who in her right mind wouldn't approve of Henry, a reporter for the Elizabeth Daily Post? Henry was smart, kind, funny, and very attractive. When he'd first enlisted right out of high school, he hoped to serve as a reporter for Stars and Stripes, since he'd been editor-in-chief of the Monticello Times, the school newspaper at Jefferson High. But after just 3 months of training, he'd been sent into battle. He said he was lucky to get out alive. Most of his company didn't. He was in the hospital for 2 months with a shot-up leg. After that, he got his wish, a desk job with Stars and Stripes in London, until 6 months after the war ended. He said he learned more from those journalists than he ever did at college. As much as Aunt Alma said she liked Henry, lately she'd been warning Leah about men in general, and Henry in particular. "Why should he buy the cow if he can get the milk for free?" Aunt Alma's advice when it came to romance was so old-world. Besides, Henry never pushed her to go too far. She might not have minded a little push. It wasn't like they were teenagers, after all. Henry had turned 28 over the summer, and she would be 24 on her next birthday. And guess what, Aunt Alma? He wasn't getting much at all, never mind for free. Though, honestly, if she turned 25 and she still wasn't engaged, she saw no point in saving it. She might as well enjoy it while she still could. She was pretty sure Aunt Alma had never enjoyed hers. When the notice had come around at school asking for volunteers, especially teachers who had experience with young children, to chaperone a holiday party at the Elks Club in Elizabeth, Leah thought her principal might be impressed to see what a community-minded young woman she was, willing to give her time on a Sunday afternoon the week before Christmas. Another teacher at her school, Harriet McKenna, also volunteered and, better yet, offered to drive Leah, saving her from waiting for the bus from Cranford to Elizabeth in this weather. When she told Henry, he said he'd be covering the event for the Daily Post and he'd have a photographer with him. So Leah chose a pretty dress in a deep winter blue, even though she knew the picture in the paper wouldn't be in color. At the last minute, she tied on an apron. You never knew when some child was going to be sick or fling something that would land on you. More than 100 kids came to the holiday party. There were plenty of volunteers, many of them parents, and they divided the children into groups by age. She and Harriet and 2 of the mothers took the 4- to 7-year-olds and handed out Dixie cups to get things going. Right away, a little girl shouted, "I got Lassie!" She licked the cover of her Dixie cup clean to show Leah. Another began to cry, "I want Lassie, too!" "Let's see who you have," Leah said, wiping the child's tears. "Go ahead and lick it clean so we can see." She did, and held it up to Leah. "Ooh, you have Natalie Wood," Leah told her. "You're lucky, because Natalie Wood is a very famous movie star, and look how pretty she is. And you know what? She was a movie star when she was your age." I'm 6.
Well, that's swell. 6 is a good age to be.
When Henry arrived with the photographer, who didn't look old enough to drive, Leah took off her apron, smoothed out her blue dress, and reapplied her lipstick. Harriet, who knew Leah and Henry were seeing each other, whispered,
"You look good enough to be the photo on a Dixie cup."
"As good as Lassie?" Leah whispered.
"Nobody can compete with Lassie."
Leah laughed, then clapped her hands to get the children's attention.
"Boys and girls," Leah said, "this is Mr. Henry Ammerman. He's a reporter for the Elizabeth Daily Post, and he's going to write a story about us."
She liked saying his name out loud. Henry Ammerman. When she did, Henry waved at the children.
"And this is Todd Dirksen," Henry said of the boy photographer. "He's going to take a picture. Maybe you'll see it in tomorrow's paper."
Todd held up his speed graphic so the children could see his camera. Henry and Todd conferred, then suggested they gather around the piano. Leah sat down and began to play the introduction to Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. She motioned for the children to sit on the floor around her. Some were still eating their Dixie cups with little wooden spoons. Some faces were already smeared with chocolate frosting from the cupcakes. Harriet ran around with a damp cloth, trying to wipe their faces clean, knowing the parents would want their children to look their Sunday best in the paper.
"All eyes here, please," Leah said,
as she continued to play and sing.
"Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say..."
Half of the children sang along with Leah. The other half were more interested in the camera or looking out the windows. Todd clicked while Leah was at her most animated. Henry waited until she'd finished the song, then called,
"Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Miss Cohen."
"You're very welcome, Mr. Ammerman."
"Happy holidays, Miss Cohen."
"Same to you, Mr. Ammerman." Oh, she really, really liked Henry Ammerman. She might say loved, but she was superstitious about using that word too soon.
Ruby. In the departure lounge at Newark Airport, Ruby was nodding off. She'd been up since 5 a.m., finishing her last-minute packing before rushing into Manhattan for the radio show. The ice cream soda at Hanson's felt like eons ago. She pulled out the sandwich bag her mother had packed for her and lifted out a cream cheese and pimento sandwich on white bread, crusts cut off, as if she were still a little girl going off to school. She was so hungry she wolfed down that sandwich, plus another, turkey and Swiss, and then an oatmeal raisin cookie. All of that made her thirsty, but her mother had filled a thermos with chamomile tea. Her mother was a big believer in the powers of herbal teas. When they finally boarded, close to 3 p.m., Ruby was seated on the right side of the cabin, next to a girl about her age, traveling with a baby. The girl's mother was seated across the aisle, holding a toddler on her lap. Ruby offered to change seats so she and her daughter could be together.
"Thank you, dear," the mother said, "but we both want to be on the aisle."
Ruby was fine with that. She liked the window seat. She saw the lady whose husband was driving to Miami, bored, and right behind her, the young man with 6 brothers. He waved and gave her a big smile. While her seatmate burped the baby, Ruby opened her book and picked up reading where she'd left off.
"He's 7 months, almost 8, her seatmate said, though Ruby hadn't asked. "The older boy is 2. My husband's coming down in a few days. It's the first time we've been apart. We're going to visit family for the holidays."
She glanced over and eyed the book Ruby was holding.
"Oh, Nicky Spillane. He grew up in Elizabeth. My uncle taught him at the high school. Not that I've read it. My husband says it might be too much for me."
Ruby could swear her seatmate blushed.
"This is my first flight," she confided. "What about you?"
"I've flown a lot."
Ruby shuddered at the thought that this girl's life could be hers,
except for her talent and determination. The stewardess, blonde and pretty, with a lisp, "Fasten your seatbelts," sashayed up and down the aisles, checking on them. When they finally began to roll, the young mother's face went white.
"I'm a little bit nervous," she whispered to Ruby.
"Take deep breaths," Ruby told her. But as soon as they took off, Ruby knew something was wrong.
"Does it always feel like this?"
her seatmate asked. Ruby didn't tell her that, no, it didn't feel like this. They were too low. They should be climbing. Why weren't they climbing?
"Can you hold the baby for a minute?"
And she shoved the baby at Ruby.
"I think I'm going to be sick."
Ruby took the baby. He clutched her necklace, a golden strawberry on a thin chain, while his mother retched. The chain broke. So what? For 7 horrible minutes, 7 minutes that felt like hours, years, a whole lifetime, everything seemed to be in slow motion. Ruby heard only the thump of her own heart, not the screaming, not the wailing, not the 200-pound wrestler seated behind her, reciting the Lord's Prayer.
This is it? This is how it's going to end? No, it has to be a mistake. Please, God, make it be a mistake.
She held the baby close, feeling the warmth of his little body, kissing his soft cheek. He looked right into her eyes. Outside the window, the wing broke away from the plane. Then they were falling, falling diagonally out of the sky. Henry. As Henry and Todd came out of the Elks Club and started down the long flight of stairs to the street, they heard a roaring sound.
"Jesus, is that what I think it is?"
Todd asked, looking skyward. He opened his camera, framed the image, then clicked. Henry hoped he'd captured the plane trailing smoke, flames billowing back nearly to the tail, maybe 100 feet above them, and banking steeply to the left.
"Your car or mine?" Todd shouted. "Mine. Let's go."
Henry already knew this would be his first front-page story. He drove with his hand on the horn, following the path of the plane.
"Get everything you can," he told Todd,
who had no experience but was the nephew of the managing editor.
"Every detail. Don't stop to think. Just do it, or you'll miss your chance."
He was talking as much to himself as to Todd. Miri. Outside the theater, the weather had grown even worse. Miri and Rusty locked arms and walked quickly with their heads down. Miri had never felt so cold, so weak from hunger. The candy bar at the movies was the only thing she'd had to eat today. A few more blocks and they'd be home. She could almost smell the leg of lamb rubbed with garlic and rosemary that would be waiting, with pan-roasted potatoes, mint jelly, and green beans, plus a wedge of iceberg lettuce with Russian dressing. Irene would have already frosted the birthday cake she'd baked for Rusty. Mary's mouth was watering just thinking about it. At the corner of Westfield Avenue and Loudoun Street, a small child, one of the Bell kids, probably, was sledding in front of her house. There was a Bell in every grade. Mary knew at least 4 of them. Suddenly, the child screamed and pointed to the sky. Mary and Rusty looked up to see a ball of fire rushing toward them. Miri could feel the heat from above as Rusty grabbed her, pulling her across the street. They ran as fast as they could, but the fireball kept coming. They heard a deafening roar, then a splintering crash, followed by 2 explosions only a second apart. They were knocked down by the force, Rusty covering Miri's body with her own, trying to protect her. When Miri opened her eyes, she saw feet, dozens of feet, and at first, she was so disoriented, she didn't know where she was. She couldn't hear anything. There was a ringing in her ears. From every direction, people were running toward the flames that were shooting up,
toward the thing that had crashed and was burning in the frozen bed of the Elizabeth River. Rusty helped Miri to her feet.
"Go home and tell Nana we're okay," she shouted. "Hurry!"
Rusty gave her a gentle shove. "Go, Miri!" She ran for home. Her feet were numb in her saddle shoes. Snot ran down her face and froze on her upper lip, on her chin, as she rounded the corner of Sayre Street and raced up the front steps.
"Nana!" she called, bursting into the house. "Nana! Where are you? Nana!" she shouted. "Nana!"
She found her under the dining room table.
"A bomb?"
Irene asked.
"No," Miri told her. "Something crashed in the river. They say it's a plane."
Irene clutched her chest. Miri grabbed her pills from the kitchen counter. Irene put one under her tongue.
"Rusty?" she asked. "She's okay."
"Thank God."
"I have to go back," Miri said.
"Over my dead body," Irene told her.
"Nana, please, I have to help."
Irene came out from under the table.
"Not without me."
She pulled galoshes over her shoes. Miri helped her into her coat, all the time arguing,
"It's too cold for you, Nana."
Cold wasn't good for Irene's angina, but Irene wouldn't listen. She wrapped a wool scarf over her mouth and nose so the wind wouldn't take her breath away. Outside, Miri held her arm, afraid Irene would slip and fall on the snow that had turned to ice from Friday's snowstorm. When they got to the crash site, Irene looked around and gave one cry. Her hand went to her heart. Miri shouldn't have let her come. She was afraid to let go of Irene's arm, afraid someone would knock her over. She didn't see Rusty anywhere, but she recognized Rabbi Halberstadter standing with a couple of priests, all of them stomping their feet in the cold. And then Uncle Henry saw them and ordered Miri to take Irene home.
"Now," he barked,
and Miri wasn't about to argue with him. Henry. He'd had to elbow his way through the crowd to where the plane lay on its back in the Elizabeth River, belly ripped open, rubble spilling into the frozen stream and onto the banks. The river was a mass of roaring flames shooting 100 feet into the air and surrounding the mangled wreckage, one wing pointing straight up. Firemen, policemen, and other rescue workers swarmed to the scene, armed with cutting torches, grappling hooks, blankets, stretchers, and bags. A white-clad intern, stethoscope around his neck, went with them. But he didn't stay long, just long enough to know he wasn't needed. When they started separating the debris, a few bodies, or parts of them, became distinguishable. The bodies were brought out in bags and folded blankets. Workers formed a chain to hand up the remains. A woman who had somehow evaded police lines and tumbled through the snow too close to the carnage was sick and had to be helped away. As darkness gathered, floodlights were set up on either bank of the river. The cutting torches went deeper into the tail. More bodies were brought out. The plane just missed taking down the water company offices, where 50 employees worked during the week. Hamilton Junior High was only a block away. These details would make it into his story. Miri. None of them was hungry that night, but Irene insisted they eat something. She whipped up scrambled eggs and toast, while Henry's girlfriend Leah told them how close the plane had come to the Elks Club.
"Henry had just left when we saw it. I ran out after him, but he was already gone. So I went back inside and started playing the piano really loud. I played a march and told the children to pretend they were elephants. One of the volunteers pulled the velvet drapes closed so the children couldn't see anything. We didn't want to frighten them, so we just kept singing and playing games until their parents came to take them home. We heard the explosions, but we pretended to be lions in the jungle, roaring. No one told the children to use their indoor voices. No one told them to settle down,
For once, they did whatever they wanted, making as much noise as they wanted. And all of them in their party clothes. All those patent leather Mary Janes. Really, I didn't know what I was doing. My friend, she went crazy. She saw it out the window and just slumped to the floor. One of the mothers had to take her to the ladies' lounge to lie down. What could I do? I was responsible for all those children. 100 children! It could have crashed into... Rusty covered Leah's hand with her own, like a big sister. But it didn't, and the children are fine, thanks to you and your quick thinking. Until then, Miri hadn't thought about how close the plane had come to her school. Suppose it had been a weekday instead of a Sunday. Suppose the plane hadn't made it to the frozen riverbed. Henry came home just long enough to drop a kiss on Leah's cheek, scarf down some food, and change into dry clothes. He must have gotten wet at the crash site. Miri could tell by the way he was walking that his leg hurt. He had a cane, but Miri had never seen him use it.
"I have to get back," Henry said. "It's the second worst air disaster in this country. The worst disaster since..."
He looked around the table, shook his head, and left. "The worst disaster since what?" Miri wondered. The doorbell rang as Miri was clearing the supper dishes.
"I'll get it,"
she called, running to the front door. It was Natalie, with her mother and little sister. They stepped into the foyer. Natalie hugged her and gushed tears.
We were so worried. I couldn't get through on the phone, and I thought, you know, because you live so close."
She took in a big breath.
"We were at the tavern when we heard, but we didn't stay to finish. They wrapped our food, and we took it with us because Daddy had to.
Corinne finished for her. Dr. Osner was called in to help identify the bodies. Miri stiffened. Fern said,
"Babies died."
"They say you could hear them crying," Natalie added.
"No," Miri said. "I was there. And you couldn't hear anything."
"Oh, my gosh," Natalie cried. "You were there?"
"I was coming home from the movies with my mother. We saw it."
Corinne hugged Miri.
"Oh, honey,"
she said in her southern drawl. Miri teared up, wishing she could apologize for her fantasy. She'd feel guilty forever for wishing something bad would happen to Corinne, who was kind and good and smelled expensive.
"Miri,
who is it?"
Rusty called.
"Come in,"
Miri told Corinne.
"Oh, no, we don't want to intrude," Corinne said. "We just wanted to make sure you were all right."
Suddenly, it seemed important for Natalie and her family to stay, to help celebrate Rusty's birthday.
"It's Rusty's birthday, and we're going to have cake."
"I love birthday cake,"
Fern said.
"Well, just for a minute," Corinne told Miri, following her into Irene's dining room.
Leah jumped up and brought extra chairs to the table.
"Please, sit," Irene told them. "Let's be happy we're all together."
"Except for Henry," Leah said.
"But thank God Henry is safe," Irene reminded her.
Irene could always find something good to say about a situation, and for the moment, Miri was grateful for both her mother and her grandmother. When Irene lit the candles on the cake and set it down in front of Rusty, Miri began to sing,
"Happy birthday!"
The others joined in. Rusty blew out the candles on her cake, 33 of them, plus one for good measure, with tears streaming down her face.
"You're not that old, are you?"
Fern asked. Rusty laughed.
"No, I'm not that old."
Then they all laughed, as if it were a real party, as if nothing bad had happened or would ever happen. Miri forgot to ask what became of the leg of lamb. Rusty,
Rain, shine, or disaster, Rusty was on the 732 train to New York. The day after the crash was no exception. She hadn't missed a day of work in 14 years, and she wasn't about to start now, just because a plane crashed into the Elizabeth River. Never mind that she'd hardly slept, that Mary had spent most of the night in her bed, both of them tossing and turning, dozing off, then waking with a start. When Mary asked if she believed in God, what was she supposed to say? "Of course I believe in God," she'd told her. "But how could God let such a terrible thing happen?" "It's not God's job to decide what happens," she'd said. "It's his job to help you get through it." If only she really believed that. On the train, her hands shook and her teeth chattered. The man seated next to her assumed she was cold and offered his coat.
"Maybe you're coming down with something."
"No, it's not that." She thanked him but refused his coat. Maybe she should have stayed home. But then Mary would have wanted to stay home too, and it was important for her to set an example, to show Mary that no matter what, you take your responsibilities seriously. She'd landed the Employee of the Year award more than once, and not just because of her exemplary attendance record. If Irene hadn't stepped up to the plate when Mary was born, Rusty wouldn't be executive secretary to Charles Whitten, senior partner at Whitten, Granger & White, one of the most respected law firms in the city. Rusty was lucky to have such a good job, such an important job, given that she'd never gone to college. She'd planned to go, had been accepted to Douglas, the women's school of Rutgers University. But things happen, things that can change your life overnight. Not that she was going to dwell on that. She'd learned a long time ago to look ahead, not back. What's done is done. Make the best of it and move on. And she had, hadn't she? None of the girls at the office asked her about the crash. They knew she commuted from New Jersey, but they were chatting about their weekends, about how their boyfriends couldn't believe Joe DiMaggio had announced his retirement. Only Mrs. Yates, head of the secretarial pool, said, "You live in Elizabeth, don't you, Rusty?"
"I do." "I heard about the crash. Tragic."
"Yes, it was."
"Glad you were able to make it to work today."
"Me too." And that was it, except for her friend Naomi. Rusty's family called her the other Naomi. They met for grilled cheese sandwiches at the coffee shop around the corner from their offices. Naomi wanted to talk about the crash, but Rusty kept changing the subject. Turned out, she didn't want to talk about it after all, or even think about it. Instead, she bummed a Chesterfield off Naomi and asked for a refill on her coffee. Mary expected school to be canceled on Monday morning, but there was no announcement on the local radio station. She wished she could stay in bed under the covers with the quilt pulled over her head. She'd slept fitfully last night, waking every hour, finally winding up in Rusty's bed, the two of them watching over each other. She'd never get rid of the stench in her nostrils, no matter how she washed them, sticking the soapy washcloth up as far as it would go, making her sneeze 20 times in a row. She tried telling herself it hadn't happened. If she went to the river today, there would be no sign of a plane. It had all been a bad dream. Even before she got downstairs, the aroma of freshly baked coffee cake wafted up from Irene's kitchen. And if it hadn't happened, why would Irene be up and baking this early?
"For the Red Cross, darling," Irene told her, while Blanche Kessler, home service chairman for the Elizabethtown chapter, packed the cakes into boxes. "To serve at the hospitality table," Blanche Kessler said, "outside the makeshift morgue behind Haynes' funeral home."
If she still had any doubts, they vanished when she got to school. They were all buzzing about it in the hall outside their homerooms.
"Where were you when you heard the news? What were you doing?"
"Suzanne,
my mother and I had just sat down to Sunday dinner
when we heard the roar, then the explosions. We put our faces into our dinner plates, pork chops, mashed potatoes, and beets. You should have seen us when it was over. Beets stain everything. I swear, I thought it was a comet. It sounded like a comet.
Angelo Vannetti. That was no comet. That was a bomb inside the plane.
Pete Wolfe.
That was no bomb. It was something from outer space. Some alien thing. Maybe Martians.
Donnie Kellen.
It's a commie plot.
Eleanor, baiting Donnie.
You sure Senator Joe McCarthy didn't take the plane down?
Donnie Kellen.
McCarthy's the one person trying to save us from the commies.
Eleanor.
McCarthy is an evil man, a bully.
Donnie Kellen, shouting.
I can't help it if you're too thick to see the truth, bitch.
Eleanor.
Idiot!
Eleanor Gordon was the most sophisticated in their crowd. She read The New Yorker. When it came to McCarthy, Mary's family agreed with Eleanor. Donnie Kellen was always ranting about the commies and how they were trying to take over the world. When the Dianetics were kicked out of town for starting a medical school without permission, he'd ranted about that, too. But Mary didn't think the Dianetics had anything to do with the commies, though she couldn't be sure. Uncle Henry had covered the story for the Daily Post. That's how Mary found out Donnie's aunt had left town with them to follow some guy named L. Ron Hubbard to Kansas. When the bell rang, they headed for their homerooms, Suzanne, Mary, and Eleanor, to 9201, Natalie and Robo, to 9202, but that didn't stop them from jabbering.
Settle down, boys and girls, Mrs. Wallace, their homeroom teacher, said.
Mrs. Wallace was so small, not even 5 feet, they called her Tiny behind her back, not Teresa, her real first name. Rumor had it she weighed under 90 pounds. Yet she was married and had 2 children, both of them in elementary school. In addition to teaching English, Tiny was the advisor to the school paper, Hamilton Headlines. Eleanor was editor-in-chief. The paper came out just 3 times during the school year, and the stories covered only school-related activities. Nothing about the rest of the world, or even the rest of the city. Mary had very little interest in the stories she was assigned to write, but she did her best, getting in the who, what, where, when, and why. On the day the paper came out, most of the kids just glanced at it, then tossed it into the wastebasket. Some didn't even bother to look before throwing it away. It galled Mary to see that, because even if it wasn't exciting to read, it was still a lot of work. Tiny said,
I can see you're upset about yesterday's situation, but now it's time to get back to normal.
Situation, Mary thought. Normal?
Mrs. Wallace, Suzanne called, waving her hand in the air.
What is it, Suzanne?
Tiny asked.
Mary was there. She saw it happen.
Why did Suzanne think she had to tell the whole world she was there? Natalie had let the girls know last night. Not that it was a secret, not that she didn't want her friends to know, but having Suzanne announce it in homeroom felt wrong. It felt like a betrayal, as if your friend blurted out one of your deepest secrets, something you never wanted anyone else to know. Everyone turned to look at Mary, including Tiny.
Then it's only right that Mary should get to choose today's psalm, Tiny said.
Every day since they'd started junior high, the morning routine in homeroom was the same. Pledge of Allegiance, followed by the singing of My Country, Tis of Thee, the reading of a psalm, then reciting the Lord's Prayer together. Tiny walked to Mary's desk and laid the Bible on it.
Psalm 100, Mary said, without opening the book.
It was the only psalm she knew by heart, the one she chose whenever it was her turn to read from the Bible.
Would you read that for us, Mary? Tiny said.
Mary thumbed through the Bible until she came to it. She cleared her throat and began very quietly.
Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands.
Usually the words meant nothing to her, but today, every word left her picturing the crash, hearing the explosions. The ringing in her ears returned. She couldn't finish. She felt like she might cry or scream, or both. Suzanne took the Bible from her and finished reading the psalm.
"I'm sorry,"
Suzanne said when the bell rang and they left for their first period classes. "I didn't know she'd make you read the morning psalm."
"It's okay," Miri told her. "Just please don't tell anyone else." "I won't."
No other teacher mentioned the crash. Right after fifth period algebra, Natalie took Miri aside in the girls' room and said,
"I have this buzzing inside my head."
"You want to go to the nurse?"
"No, it's not like that."
"Maybe it's your period," Miri said.
"This is different," Natalie told her. "And when the buzzing stops, Ruby starts talking to me."
"Ruby?"
"The dancer who was on that plane. Didn't you listen to Walter Winchell last night? He spent half his show talking about her."
As soon as she admitted Ruby was talking to her, before Miri even had the chance to take it in, Natalie grabbed her shoulders.
"Swear you won't tell anyone what I just said."
What could Miri do? Natalie was her best friend. She had no choice but to swear she would never tell. For the rest of the day, whenever the other kids were buzzing about the crash, Miri was thinking about the buzzing in Natalie's head. Obituaries. Mrs. Estelle Sapphire of Bayonne was among the first identified at the makeshift morgue set up in the two garages behind Haynes' funeral home. She was identified by her wedding ring. Her husband, Benjamin Sapphire, collapsed at the scene and was taken by police car to the home of a friend. The Christmas pageant was just days away, and Miri had choir rehearsal after school. When she got home, she found a strange man in Irene's living room, sitting in the wing chair, wrapped in one of Irene's crocheted afghans, his feet soaking in a pan of warm water, his trouser legs rolled up to reveal the hairiest legs Miri had ever seen. Even his toes were covered with dark hair. If she didn't know better, she'd have sworn they were animal legs.
"Miri, darling, this is Ben Sapphire," Irene said, handing him a steaming cup of tea, or maybe it was soup. "He was freezing cold," Irene told her. "His hands and feet were blue. I thought for sure they'd have to take him to the hospital."
He was still shivering, but he managed to say,
"Irene was serving home-baked coffee cake."
"Which one?" Miri asked. "Sour cream with cinnamon and walnuts, or streusel?"
He looked to Irene for an answer.
"Sour cream," she said, leading Miri into the kitchen where she whispered, "We knew each other in the old days, in Bayonne. He lost his wife in the crash."
Miri didn't want to think about the crash.
"I'll be upstairs," she told Irene. "Call me when it's time to set the table for supper."
She and Rusty and Uncle Henry ate at Irene's every night. Irene was a great cook, which was Rusty's excuse for never having learned. Instead of encouraging her, Rusty said Irene shooed her out of the kitchen. Rusty was always harping that Miri should learn to cook, that Irene would have more patience with Miri than she'd had with her. Learning to cook from Irene would be a lot better than making lumpy and disgusting white sauce in the required cooking class at Hamilton Junior High. The leg of lamb materialized as lamb stew that night. Tasty, with little potatoes, green beans, carrots, and celery, seasoned with rosemary. Ben Sapphire joined Miri and Rusty at Irene's table. He broke down several times, covering his eyes with his hand, blowing his nose with a handkerchief.
"I can't think of her inside that plane. My darling wife, my Estelle."
Irene patted his hand.
"We took a place in Miami Beach for the season," he told Rusty. "She was flying down early to get it ready. I was going to drive down with the luggage. She gets carsick.
got carsick. Never liked long drives.
He broke down again. I'm so sorry, Rusty said. I spoke with her on the phone on Saturday. She ordered 6 Volupte compacts to take to Florida.
The compacts, he said, hitting his forehead with his hand. I forgot about the compacts.
Again, Irene patted his hand.
Never mind about that.
No, I want to pay.
Please, Ben.
Irene shook her head. Miri stole a look at Rusty, who took her hand under the table and gave it a gentle squeeze. Rusty's fingers were warm.
Henry came home as they were finishing what was left of Rusty's birthday cake. He was flushed with excitement, dropping a stack of papers on one end of the table, then handing each of them a copy of the Daily Post with his story and byline on the front page. He had no idea who Ben Sapphire was, but he passed a copy of the paper to him, too. Ben Sapphire took one look and turned gray. He excused himself from the table, and Irene helped him to the bathroom. When she came back without Ben, she told Henry, "His wife, Estelle, was on that plane."
"How was I supposed to know?"
Henry asked.
"Sometimes you have to assume," Irene said.
Then she turned to Mary.
"Darling, give me that paper."
But Mary held on to it.
"She's been through enough," Irene said to Henry. "She doesn't need the gruesome details."
"She was there, Mama,"
Henry said.
"She saw it happen.
And that's bad enough."
"You don't think she's going to read the paper tonight?"
Henry said.
"You don't think she'll want to read my story?"
Mary wasn't sure she wanted to read Henry's story, but she didn't say so. She didn't say anything. On the one hand, she wanted to forget it ever happened. On the other, she wanted to know who else was on the plane besides the dancer and Ben Sapphire's wife, Estelle. She wanted to know why it crashed.
"Tomorrow, there'll be a story about Paul Stefanelli, the youngest of 7 brothers,"
Henry said.
"Came through the war without a scratch and died on that plane. He worked at Ronson's. And later this week, I'm interviewing Ruby Granick's family. I'm talking to anyone who has a story to tell, and so far, that's pretty much everyone."
Mary wished she could tell him about Natalie. She was betting Natalie was the only one who heard Ruby's voice.
"What about us?" Mary asked. "Are you interviewing Mom and me?"
"Would you like me to?"
Henry asked.
"No,"
Rusty said.
"Enough is enough. She's too young to understand. None of us can make sense of it. How can you expect a young girl to?"
"Not by sweeping it under the rug and pretending it didn't happen," Henry said.
"Since when are you the expert?" Rusty asked. "When you have a young, impressionable daughter, we'll discuss it."
Until then, Mary had never heard an angry word between Rusty and Henry. She couldn't believe they were talking this way in front of her, as if she weren't sitting right there. This was a first, after a lifetime of silences, of secrets, of pretending everything was fine. Irene pushed her chair back from the table, signaling the end of this argument.
"I'm going to check on Ben."
"Mary, don't you have homework?"
Rusty said. "Oh, sure. Homework. The answer for everything."
Elizabeth Daily Post. 56 killed as flaming plane crumples, falls into frozen river. By Henry Ammerman. December 17th. Elizabeth, long fearful because of its proximity to Newark Airport, gained a permanent listing in the annals of aviation tragedy at 3:09 o'clock yesterday afternoon when a 2-engined non-scheduled airliner plummeted in flames into the east bank of the Elizabeth River only 7 minutes after its takeoff. All 52 passengers and the 4 crew died, the most tragic civil catastrophe in Elizabeth's 3 centuries of existence. Thousands in streets already flooded with holiday shoppers turned their eyes skyward to the thunderous roar of a low-flying plane in trouble. They gaped in horror as a thin streak of smoke turned to flame, and the plane struggled to return to the airport before its right wing